email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, an exciting new exhibition has opened today. It tells the story of how our nation was born and developed over the decades. It opens on a week which marks the 75th anniversary of Ireland becoming a republic. Back in 1949, the exhibition takes place in the Coach House at Dublin Castle, and it's called Society and State, Ireland Through Its Records. And joining me now in studio to tell me all about it is the Director of the National Archives, Orla McBride. Hello, Orla.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Thanks for taking time out. Or is all your work done? All the work's done?
Well, all the hard work's done.
Yeah.
But it's open now. We've launched it and it's out there and it's opened, and hopefully the public will come and see it.
So January of every year, we hear about the things that are becoming coming out into the public domain after 30 years. So these are the publications and the letters and all that. That's what's part of this exhibition.
So the exhibition really, yeah. So all the records that are held in the National Archives, we have 50 million. So obviously this is only a snapshot.
Right.
Yeah, so this is 100 records.
Okay.
But we've chosen 100 records that we think tell the stories of the evolution of the Irish state. So once we were established in December 1922, the first thing the new government did was begin to build a new nation. So the task of state building, in effect. So the records that we have in the exhibition tell the stories of the state over those 100 years.
So we had to start from scratch.
We did, yeah.
We did. Like moving into a new house. So you had to pick colours out.
So I have here before me, Ray, a little sample, which is the flag. So
right.
The tricolour. So we all know that the tricolour obviously was in existence before the new state came into being, but they had to formally approve the colours.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what exact colour would the orange be? What exact colour would the green
yes.
be? So they had to make those decisions. Then coinage, money.
Yes.
So they established a coinage committee so that they could choose the different denominations and the designs for the different
and
denominations.
And what animal or bird would
go on
the
each exactly. And
coin.
The first two coins that were minted, the silver and the gold, were sent to the Vatican.
Right.
So even in those very early days in the 1920s.
Strong connection.
In the 1920s, that connection with the church had already been established.
Here's a tangential question here. Are there minutes of those meetings?
Yeah, we have all the minutes of every cabinet meeting.
But you know, the people choosing which bird, is it a hen or whatever, pigeon that we're going to put on a coin?
Yeah, they're all...
They're all there.
They're all in the National Archives. Yeah,
wow.
It's a treasure trove, really. And in a way, you see, people kind of think, oh, they're the official records of the state. They're the state papers. But behind every decision of government, regardless of what it is, it affects the lives of all of us, ordinary people.
Yeah.
So you take a government decision and then... What does that tell you about the lives
yes.
of people? So in the exhibition, for example, you know, we have a focus on health and education. So obviously we all know in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s in Ireland, like TB was huge.
Mm.
So we have government decisions in relation to the introduction of a vaccination programme and the BCGs, or the expansion of the sanatoria network across the country. All those government decisions affected people's lives.
Of course.
You know, we have a lovely letter here from Don O'Malley to Sean Lamass. And Don O'Malley, as we know,
introduced free
secondary education to Ireland.
1966, 67, yeah.
Up until then, children left school at 14.
Right.
He introduced that. Now, I mean, it's famous for people not knowing that it was about to happen, like his cabinet colleagues didn't know. But the letter that we have in the exhibition very clearly shows that Sean Lamass knew it was coming.
Uh-huh.
But he was writing Sean Lamass to say, just so you know.
But the cabinet didn't know.
No, I'm going to make a speech on Saturday night where I'm not going to say it explicitly, but I'm more or less going to announce that that we're introducing free secondary education in Ireland. And I would actually say that probably that was one of the most transformative things to happen in Ireland in all of those decades.
We have a radio report about that.
Education for our young featured significantly on the political scene this year. The Minister for Education, Mr. O'Malley.
I'm a realist, and I had to deal with the crying needs of our young children who thirst for education so much, and so many of whom cannot afford it at the present time as things stand. 61,500 secondary pupils going to day schools next year will benefit by free education.
Yeah, transformative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
no, it's quite extraordinary.
Mm.
So
that was just for people. Sean Dignan was there because we're going to play a number of clips, and people won't hear these clips at the exhibition, but
no,
this
but
is
they'll
a,
see
this
the
is a
records.
Co-production.
There's a co-production. So they'll see the records.
They'll see the records, yes, yeah, yeah. Go on, sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, I was just going to say, you know, so health, education, infrastructure, you know, so we look at all the different ways in which you build a state. So you provide an education system, you provide a health system, but then you look at infrastructure. So there's a whole focus, for example, on the electrification of Ireland and Ardna Crusha. There's a whole focus then on popular culture. And
yeah, you go from, say, Yeats getting the Nobel Prize to Linda Martin win the Eurovision.
That's right.
But it's all in there.
All in there, but we start much earlier with the dance halls.
Yes. Now, I saw Ken Loach's movie, Jimmy's Hall.
Yes.
Have you seen that?
Yes, yes.
And it's about a dance hall in rural Ireland and the local priest trying to ban it.
Yes.
Based on a true story.
Yes, yeah. That's right. And I have here in front of me, it's a Garda report from Limerick on the dance halls. And because the guards were policing the dance halls. And there's here, they speak about the sale of drink is always carefully supervised by the Gardaí. And then, obviously, this is a report as to the behaviour in a particular dance hall down in Limerick.
Right. Give us the year again.
This is 1938.
Okay.
As regards immorality at dances, no complaints in this connection have been received by the Gardaí.
Right.
Because mostly the parish priests would have always been...
Complained to the guards about immorality.
Absolutely.
Immorality, not immortality.
Absolutely.
That's a different thing completely.
So the guards supervised everything. And then obviously these reports, so if you were going to get your new licence to run your dance hall, you needed a good report from the Gardaí. So you needed to ensure that there was no...
So throughout this exhibition, there's obviously a lot about the church and the explicit... lay out how the church affected the state?
Not explicitly, but you can see here, say, for example...
Read between the lines.
You read between the lines. We are explicit in that one of the biggest things to happen after the foundation of the new state was the Eucharistic Congress of 1932. 1 million people came to the Mass. It was almost like, you know, you think about it now, technologically, it was extraordinary. They actually had a giant screen and they had the Pope beamed in from Rome, speaking to the 1 million people, the congregation. My own personal story in relation to the Eucharistic Congress, where love stories begin. My grandparents, my grandmother emigrated from Donegal to...
I don't know if I'm going to cover my ears here. No, go on.
My grandmother emigrated from Donegal to New York in the late 1920s as a young woman, and she was living in New York, and the Eucharistic Congress then was planned for 1932. And like, it was so huge, emigrants came home. So my granny came home from New York, and my grandfather, who was a national school teacher on Gola Island in Donegal, he came down to the Eucharistic Congress because it was the biggest thing ever. Yeah. And he met my grandmother. And
you wouldn't be here.
Love
that
stories.
Didn't happen.
The Eucharistic Congress, where love stories began.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it was huge. And again, you know, you could see very clearly the influence of the church through all of our records, but that was one of the biggest kind of manifestations of the importance and the centrality of the church to Irish life.
It did loom large, and I know you cover censorship as well, and certain books and movies that would have been banned over the years.
Yes, because there was the Censorship of Films Act and then there was the Censorship of Publications Act. So I have here before me, it's a page from the Film Censors, and it's the Appeals Board, and it's the 30th of January 1962 Breakfast at Tiffany's. We all love Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn. What I love here is the length of it. So we would talk about films being 2 hours, 10 minutes or 1 hour, 90 minutes. This was obviously a film reel. So it's 10,445 feet. So anyway, the board cannot recommend the issuing of a certificate for this film, and that's signed by the chair. But it says this utterly amoral film, which is played with such innocence by Audrey Hepburn. So obviously they felt that she had almost been taken advantage of.
So they want to protect her.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're going to protect the Irish people anyway. It has been shown nowhere in the world to children or adolescents. But they were going to go further. It was going to be shown to no one in Ireland. I do not think it is fit for exhibition here in this country.
Right. 1962.
1962, the 30th of January.
And back then, if it was banned in 1 year, it was banned forever. Now, that law has changed since.
Yes.
But we have a recording of Jack White, who was the head of public affairs at RTE in the 1960s. And then he went on to become the controller of television programmes in 1974. And he's discussing censorship. This is from 1961.
Like a lot of other people, I disapprove of censorship entirely in theory. In practice, I'm perfectly well aware that there is, you might call it an industry, for the production of commercial pornography. You can see it on the bookstalls if you go to London. I don't think that it's any hardship on the Irish people to be deprived of that. I wouldn't really have any serious complaint, even against our present act, if it were applied intelligently, as I think it's being applied on the whole at the moment. The one thing that I think needs to be corrected is this. So far as I know, once the limited period for appeal against a ban has passed, there is no further method, short of an act of the eructus, by which a book can be put into circulation again. We are stuck forevermore with the errors or aberrations of all previous censorship boards, and they have succeeded between them in depriving us of clearing off from our bookstalls and out of our bookshops and out of our libraries a very large proportion of the finest work of the most important authors of this century.
Very diplomatic, wasn't it there?
Very diplomatic.
From Jack White. We're talking to Orla McBride, who's the director of the National Archives. And today they've launched a new exhibition, Society and State, Ireland Through Its Records, and it runs through to September. And then it's going to be down at the Ploughing during September. Perfect for school tours, I'd suggest, Orla.
Yeah, no, it really, really is, yeah.
Because it brings history to life.
It brings history to life. And I think I was talking to someone who was at it earlier this morning. Now, she was an older lady and she said, it's the playbook to my life. Mm. But then there were young people in it who didn't know anything, who didn't know any of it at all. And they were like, isn't that fascinating that happened in Ireland?
Yeah.
So I think it will absolutely appeal to older people because, as I say, it's almost the playbook to their lives. And it'll appeal to younger people who will be looking at it as if it's from a different country.
Yeah, a different planet, yeah. While we're in the 60s, we have a recording here from New Ross from 1963 when the President of the United States of America came to visit his homestead.
He did.
It's funny because the man who's the MC at the time, a guy called Andrew Minahan, Chairman of the Urban District Council, he's having trouble with his microphone. Yeah, and it's a big day. It's a big day in New Ross, but the technology is letting them down.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Some pressman has walked on this. We're in right trouble now. We must keep to a tight schedule. So unfortunately, as I've seen, the communications have broken down, but I've heard them speak before, and I'm sure he can be heard by each and every one of you. And now, people of New Ross and people of Ireland, I give you President Kennedy of the United States.
I'm glad to be here. It took 115 years to make this trip. And 6,000 miles. And three generations. When my great-grandfather left here to become a cooper in East Boston, he carried nothing with him except two things: a strong religious faith and a strong desire for liberty.
Now, JFK there in New Ross in 1963, and he features in the exhibition.
He features in the exhibition in the section looking at emigration. So we have three letters from three international leaders, all of whom have Irish ancestry. So obviously that's JFK, and there's a lovely letter from him back to De Valera after he returned back to the White House, and it's wonderful. It's on, you know, White House headed paper, and it's just thanking the Irish people, really. For him, it was the trip of a lifetime. And then we have a letter from Nixon, and he had actually Kildare ancestry. Yes. No, don't ask me where in Kildare now.
Oh, I remember this because I was in first class and we were brought up to the main street with our little American flags.
Well, there
and
you go.
I saw him. I was within sort of 10 feet.
So
of
his
him.
Maternal ancestry, they were Quakers.
I think
it's from
Ballytor, yes.
They were,
Ballytor.
Well, wherever the Quaker,
yes,
Quakers
Ballytor,
from,
yes. Now
from
it's all
Kildare.
Coming back to me, yes.
There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the third letter is from Tony Blair, whose mother was from Ballyshannon in
right.
the county of Donegal.
Uh-huh.
So that's just to kind of show, you know, world leaders, but who had Irish ancestry. So the Nixon one is great because they sent us a piece of moon rock.
Where is that now?
I have no idea.
Misplaced. Somebody's pocket.
Somebody's drawer. The moon rock. I've no idea.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And he says that. And was there a flag, a mention of an Irish flag in that letter as well?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. On the moon.
Yeah. Now the social change in Ireland over those 75 years, it's colossal, isn't it?
It's colossal and really speaks to that. And
let's take women now, for example, women and their role in society and how that has changed.
Yeah, and one of the most formative things really, or the most important things that happened in terms of women in Irish life, was the lifting of the marriage bar. And that was a precondition to our entering the EEC.
In 1973.
So, yeah. So in 1973.
I didn't know that. So yes. It says you can join our club, but you have to allow women to work after they get married.
Equal pay for men and women.
Right.
So equal pay meant, so we had to.
So it was wasn't specifically the marriage bar. No.
But the marriage bar was our obstacle
to equal pay.
You know, for any of us, my mother, the day she married, she had to give up teaching in a state school. So, So the 1970s, we really, you can see that very significant social and cultural change that happened in Ireland. So we do have Ireland joining the EC, the lifting of the marriage bar, and then there's a wonderful letter from Mary Robinson, and it's to Cosgrave, and it's in 1973, and they're debating the legalisation of contraception in the Shannon. And she has to leave the debate, and she's really sorry she has to leave the debate. So she writes to the Taoiseach to say, you know, my apologies for leaving. But she had a dinner that she had to go to with her husband. Now, this is 1973.
Right.
And she said, and if I didn't go, he would have divorced me. Joking,
right.
Given that the 73 and we didn't introduce divorce into Ireland until 1996. And then we do have a feature on Mary Robinson. Obviously, her election as the first female president of Ireland was extraordinary.
Huge. And we have a clip from her inauguration speech.
I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon Aheron. The women of Ireland, Manon Aheron, who instead of rocking the cradle, rocked the system.
So we have some wonderful, obviously wonderful records relating to Mary Robinson's election. But then we have really fun things in it. Like we have the seating plan from the banquet following her inauguration.
Uh-huh.
And we have the menu. So, you know, so they had smoked salmon in aspic vinaigrette. And then they had cream of spinach and dill soup. That was followed by roast poussin glazed with almonds, honey and mustard seed. They had palm coquettes, cherry tomatoes in basil cream sauce, braised chicory and garden peas. That was followed by a selection of Irish cheeses. And then they had chocolate parfait with raspberry coulis, Symphony of Winter Fruits, and then they had coffee and petit four.
Right, so it was winter fruits. So wasn't what date was it? Do you have it? Was it November? Was it November?
It was November.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's always November, isn't
it? Yeah, because I remember she was on the den.
Actually, it was the third. The dinner, the banquet, was the 3rd of December 1990.
Right, so she would have been, elected in November, thereabouts, yeah.
And it was interesting even to look at the guests that were at the dinner, you know, that she had the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, she had John Hume, Gareth Fitzgerald, and, you know, and they very carefully, so they had the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Catherine Lalumière, obviously French. They knew John Hume was fluent in French, as was Gareth Fitzgerald.
Yes,
so
yes.
They were both put on either side of her. So it was very carefully thought through in terms of even the
like
seating
a wedding,
plan.
Like a wedding. Yeah.
Don't put Auntie Mary beside Cousin Rose.
They don't get on. Remember that thing back in the 1970s. Society and State, Ireland through its records. Fascinating. It's in the Coach House at Dublin Castle. It runs until September. And as we were saying, ideal for a school tour for anybody who's interested in how we got to where we are now as a modern European state. Orla, thanks so much for coming in. Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.